From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, no deal in Iran nuclear talks yet. Nigeria election results expected Monday. Arab leaders vow to defeat Yemen rebels. Christians celebrate Palm Sunday. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. A senior U.S. official says the talks on Iran's nuclear program are tough and getting even more difficult as a Tuesday deadline approaches. The remaining issues still being negotiated at the talks in Lausanne, Switzerland, have been left to the end, as VOA's Al Pessin reports.
The U.S. official said senior negotiators continue to put ideas on the table during their two or three daily meetings, but they've not found the right combination of terms on the remaining issues. The official spoke under the condition reporters not identify the person or publish direct quotes. The official indicated remaining issues include future Iranian research and development on nuclear enrichment and the pace and timing of relief from economic sanctions. The official said no one is giving up on finding a solution and predicted the talks will go right up to the deadline Tuesday night. The negotiators are not promising an agreement, and if they reach one, they're not saying what form it will take. This is only an interim step to agree on the major elements of an accord. Three more months of negotiating are planned to draft a final, fully detailed agreement. For the United States and its negotiating partners, that means verifiable guarantees that Iran's nuclear program is purely peaceful. For Iran, the key goal is the easing and eventual end of international economic sanctions. Al Pessin, VOA News, Lausanne.
The head of Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission says it will be Monday at the earliest before a clear result is known in the country's presidential election. Atuhiro Jega made the announcement Sunday at the end of a second day of voting that had been called after technical problems and delays slowed down voting on Saturday. President Goodluck Jonathan is running for re-election against Muhammadu Buhari, a former military ruler. The 57-year-old president and his People's Democratic Party are facing a tough challenge from the All Progressives Congress and General Buhari, who is 72. Arab leaders are vowing to continue the Saudi-led airstrikes in Yemen until Iran-backed Houthi rebels surrender and withdraw from territory they have seized. The announcement Sunday came at the end of a two-day summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Arab League Secretary General Nabil Al-Arabi said Yemen's legitimate government, headed by President Abdel Rab Mansour al-Hadi, must be restored. Leaders at the summit also agreed to create a joint Arab military force to deal with a growing security threat in the region. Working out the makeup and structure of that force is expected to take several months. Tunisian security forces say they have killed the main suspect in the deadly museum attack that targeted foreign tourists. Tunisia's state news agency says Abu Sakr Lokman was killed along with eight others Saturday during an anti-terrorist operation in the Gaza region near the Algerian border. Officials say Lokman's group, affiliated with the North African branch of Al-Qaeda, organized the March 18th attack on the Bardo Museum that left 21 foreign tourists and a Tunisian policeman dead. On Sunday, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Tunis to protest extremist violence in the country. The German Wings co-pilot accused of intentionally crashing his plane into the Alps may have had vision problems in addition to being treated by psychologists. The German newspaper Bild am Sonntag reports investigators found evidence that 27-year-old co-pilot Andreas Lubitz feared losing his eyesight due to a detached retina. Prosecutors say searches of Lubitz's home have uncovered documents that suggested an existing illness and appropriate medical treatment. Police also found evidence that he was treated for a psychological illness. The newspaper reported that Lubitz's girlfriend was pregnant. French officials say the plane's flight recorders indicate that Lubitz locked the pilot out of the cockpit before the jet crashed last Tuesday, killing all 150 people on board. A funeral was held Sunday for former Singapore Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew. In attendance was former U.S. President Bill Clinton, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, South Korean President Park Geun-hye, and Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Mr. Lee, called the founding father of Singapore, died last Monday at the age of 91. Christians around the world celebrated Palm Sunday. Robert Berger attended festivities in the city where the events took place.
Bells summoned the faithful to Palm Sunday prayers at the ancient Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem's Old City. Palm Sunday marks the beginning of Easter Holy Week and Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Priests and monks in festive robes led a colorful procession around the ancient stone tomb where tradition says Jesus was buried and rose from the dead. Pilgrims from around the world marched behind them in a fragrant cloud of incense, waving palm and olive branches. They came from faraway countries like Jenny and Tebby from Australia.
Palm Sunday is a very special day for Christians, and it's lovely to see how welcoming everyone is to the Christians that come here and the enjoyment that everyone gets.
Jerusalem will be awash with Christian and Jewish pilgrims later this week as Christian Good Friday coincides with Jewish Passover. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Liberian authorities are urging Ebola survivors to refrain from unprotected sex beyond the recommended 90 days after the country's first Ebola death in more than a month. The female patient who died Friday was married to a man who had the disease but survived. Officials fear she may have gotten sick through sexual transmission. The 44-year-old woman was Liberia's first confirmed case of Ebola in more than a month. Officials in Afghanistan say a suicide blast killed at least three people and wounded eight others Sunday in Kabul. Interior Ministry spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui told VOA a child is among the dead and the victims are all civilians. Eyewitnesses say people had gathered at the residence of an Afghan lawmaker for a local dispute resolution when a suicide bomber walked in and detonated his explosives. Siddiqui says a lawmaker was slightly wounded in the blast. Here in the United States, Indiana Governor Mike Pence says he does not regret approving a new state law that many say could allow for legalized discrimination against gays on the basis of protecting religious beliefs. The law essentially keeps the government from forcing people and businesses to provide services they find objectionable on religious grounds. Some gay rights organizations have called in a state-sponsored waiver for discrimination. Activists have called for a boycott of the state. Some businesses and groups say they plan to do less business in Indiana. That's it for this edition of International Edition. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Business News on the Voice of America. ABN AMRO board members are giving up a $110,000 pay increase after the Dutch government delayed a decision on selling the nationalized bank amid public outrage at the raise. The directors made the announcement Sunday in a statement. The bank announced this month that most of its directors had received the pay increase to compensate for the fact that they were banned from receiving bonuses after the bank was nationalized in 2008. Anger at the decision led the Dutch finance minister to announce Friday he was delaying selling the bank. He welcomed Sunday's decision, saying that he would reconsider the sale after a parliamentary debate. Standard Chartered remains committed to Islamic banking and expects growth in its core markets, according to a spokesman for the lender Sunday, after the head of its Islamic arm departed. Afek Khan left Standard Chartered Sadiq, the lender's global Islamic banking business, after 12 years with the Asia-focused bank, to take a career break, according to the spokesman. A successor will be announced in due course, he added. The departure follows the naming of the group's new chief executive, Bill Winters, who is expected to oversee a shakeup when he takes over in June in a bid to reverse a two-year slump. Best Buy plans to close some of its stores and consolidate its operations in Canada, the United States electronic retailer's second-largest market, in a move that will hurt earnings this year, according to the company on Saturday. The retailer said it will close 66 of its Future Shop brand stores in Canada and convert 65 of them to Best Buy brand stores. The move to a single brand will cut 500 full-time and 1,000 part-time jobs and cost the company about $200 million in restructuring charges, Best Buy said, according to Reuters. That's a look at business news on the Voice of America. As March Madness reaches its crescendo next week with the Final Four and championship game, David Byrd takes in the comedy of a struggling basketball team on today's edition of Now. But first, the recent thaw in relations between the United States and Cuba now has opera fans savoring some performances new to them, as Cuban opera has made its way north to New York City and to the American Cafe with Ira Melman. That's coming up right now.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. The dramatic easing of diplomatic and cultural relations between the United States and Cuba, initiated by President Obama in December, continues. Recently, excerpts from Cubanacan, the first new opera to be written in Cuba in 50 years, was sung in a New York art gallery for a small group of reporters and potential patrons. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the opera's American producer, its composer, and its diva.
That's the Cuban soprano Barbara Yanes singing an aria that occurs early on in Cubanacan. The opera follows the fortunes of architect Ricardo Porro, who was commissioned by Fidel Castro to design Cuba's world-famous art schools for the post-revolutionary Cuba of the early 1960s. In this scene, which takes place before the revolution, Selma, Porro's well-placed friend, informs him that dictator Fulgencio Batista's forces know of his support for Castro and tells him he must flee Cuba for his own safety. Charles Koppelman, Cubanacan's American producer and librettist, is proud that this project is being showcased, even in this modest way, in the Big Apple.
I'm thrilled. I'm very excited. I've been developing this opera for 11 years, and I started it because I had to. I needed to. I wanted to. The story had to be told. It wouldn't let go of me. And the fact that time is sort of caught up, and now Cuba is on people's radar, big changes with the United States, makes it a perfect time for this opera, I believe. I was just a little bit ahead of the curve, but I think we're going to see more of these kind of collaborations.
Koppelman says that much of Cuba's vast artistic wealth remains unknown in the U.S.
You would be amazed, not just in opera and music and dance, fine art, you name it. The work is fantastic, and a little of it does get out, and certainly around the world. But I think with the easing, Americans will be able to tune in a little better to what this is all about.
The riches can flow both ways. Through a translator, soprano Barbara Yanes tells the VOA she's excited to be in New York, home of the famed Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and, of course, the Metropolitan Opera itself.
To be there at the entrance of a museum and to see all its fabulous works of art from around the world is when you really feel an emotional connection.
In the opera's storyline, as in life, things did not work out well for the architect. Many of the art schools got built, but changing Cuban politics prevented several from being completed. In this aria, Selma informs Porro that he is once again out of favor with the authorities. This time it's Castro, and that he must return to exile. Much like Cuban-American relations throughout history, Cubanacan contains tragedy, farce, and beauty. Still, this opera represents an important personal and professional achievement for composer Roberto Valera. At 76, Valera remembers pre-revolutionary Cuba well and has spent his career teaching music at the very art schools that form the dramatic backdrop of the work. Valera is hopeful that art will help the U.S. and Cuba experiment with friendship after their long-time estrangement has failed.
I think it's important that we communicate, speak, and begin to untangle everything that has been tangled for so many years. Music is a universal art, an art that needs no translation. We know to communicate and discuss it, and as a result, we have been able to arrive at favorable conclusions that make our main objective as artists possible, to create beauty.
Cubanacan is scheduled to premiere at the Havana Biennale in May. After the Arts Festival, producers and stars alike hope it will be invited on a world tour that will include the capitals of Europe, along with China, San Francisco, and New York. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Hear us every day at voanews.com.
everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. With the success of the Netflix series House of Cards, Yahoo has released its own direct-to-web series, Sin City Saints, a comedy about a struggling basketball team in Las Vegas.
People always ask me, Jeff, why would you buy an expansion team? You need another toy? I did it because I miss the excitement that comes with trying to build something. Over All-Star break, if you happen to impregnate a woman, which some of you will, make sure she's tall. Because in 20 years, I'm going to draft your illegitimate children. All right, baby? Yeah, right. Let's get it.
The series on Yahoo Screen premiered last week in the now familiar all-episodes-at-once format. Saints stars Andrew Santino as tech mogul Jake Tullis, who made his fortune as an internet disruptor in the field of big data. He buys a basketball team in Las Vegas. His team is so bad and his players are so out of control that the league sends special counsel Dusty Halford, played by Malin Ackerman, to keep the team from failing. Ackerman says that when she thinks about the number of people who could see the show online versus those who would watch it over traditional television or even on demand, it's staggering.
I think when you hear the number that, you know, a billion people look at a website in a week, that's a bigger number than any television show that you're ever going to do. So, and it's worldwide, which is amazing. I think the world's shifting, the world of television, the world of film. It's new content. It's great. We're all on the internet watching movies nowadays, watching our TV shows. So why not make one for the internet?
Santino says that everyone in the cast has seen the huge success of Netflix, and they have no problem doing a series that is streamed online instead of broadcast over the airwaves.
What Netflix has done is so massive and obvious and successful that other people are now following suit. And I think you'd kind of have to be a little bit close-minded to be like, I'm only going to do this one medium. It's like our whole gig of being actors is to get in and create and work on something and do something we enjoy, and however it's able to get out, whatever that medium is.
The series also features former NBA players Rick Fox and Baron Davis. Davis says that some of the outlandish things that viewers will see happen on Sin City Saints are true to life. They really happened in professional sports.
You know, I think that's the good thing about the show is that it's authentic to stuff that actually really happens in people's lives in the, you know, in the world of sports.
Executive producer Michael Tolan says fans can look for things they might recognize from their favorite sports team, and not always good things.
If you really drill down the origins of every story, you'll find a seed of reality. So whether it's tanking, whether it's trying to influence a politician in the interest of getting a vote for public funding for an arena, whether it's intra-office romance or intra-team romance, right? Whether it's, you know, a mascot committing a felony. Look it up.
Tom Arnold plays Kevin Freeman, a private casino host and a fixer for the Sin City Saints. And does he think the NBA will ever have a team in Las Vegas? Well, that's complicated.
I would love to see a team in Vegas. It would be very complicated to see an NBA team in Vegas, but, you know, better than London, where they're trying to do stuff, you know?
With Sin City Saints, Yahoo is hoping to stake a claim to part of the multi-billion dollar entertainment streaming market. Netflix has been associated with new creative content, like House of Cards, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and a new show, Bloodline. This year, the company has released 9 new programs. Other streaming services like Amazon, iTunes, Google Play Hulu, and Crackle YouTube will have to keep pace. All of these services are hoping they can satisfy 2 basic cravings of viewers: entertainment choices and the ability to binge watch, watching as many shows as they want at one time. So what about you? Do you watch streaming video more than over-the-air programming, even on demand or cable or satellite? How do you get your entertainment? Well, let us know by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Selfie sticks, you've probably heard about them. those little things that you stick out in front of you with a camera, take your own picture. Yeah, you can do that, but not if you're going to a festival. U.S. festivals are listing them as prohibited items, including at Indio, California, April 10th, at Coachella, and, of course, Lollapalooza, which takes place in Grant Park, Chicago, July 31st to August the 2nd this year. Also, issuing a warning for you not to bring your selfie sticks. You can take a selfie and send it to us. We don't care. Time for sports on The Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. Australia completed its climb from the depths to the heights of world cricket Sunday as it won its fifth World Cup by defeating New Zealand by 7 wickets in the final at Melbourne Cricket Ground. Less than 2 years ago, many of the same players on the team departed winless and in disarray from the Champions Trophy. That was the last global tournament in the one-day international format. Meanwhile, Richie Ramsey has won the Trophy Hassan second golf tournament in Morocco for his third European Tour title. The Scot finished with a round of 69 for 10 under par for a one-shot margin of victory. We have more from Nick Dye.
Ramsey's regarded as one of the most consistent players on tour, and yet, by his own admission, there were fireworks on the final day.
It's a great honour to probably have one of these. I know Reese and David Horsey quite well, so you know, they've got one, so now I'm joining the club, which is fantastic. It's just, you know, it's something that's special. You come out to European Tour and we go to so many great places, and Morocco is one of them, and the fact that you know, you have this on offer is a great incentive to come here and play well and go away with a piece of history.
He had 4 straight birdies to lead on the front nine, but threw the gains away over the next 2 holes. He then birdied 3 on the back nine and held firm as Wattel came up just short, unable to close the gap.
Well, that's always disappointing, I guess, to finish so close after a tournament. But in the same time, I'm happy. I'm disappointed and I'm happy because I was not playing. That was not my best week at all. I was not playing so good. And to be in contention without playing my best, I was quite happy.
Ramsey's been struggling for a considerable time with back problems. He'd missed cut after cut this season, so the win is out of the blue, but there's no doubting his class. George Katsia, who needed to win to earn a spot at the Masters, finishes tied third, while Jose Maria Olazabal returns to Augusta, knowing his form is good after a top 10 finish.
Nick Dye reporting. Well, we can't do this without mentioning March Madness. The Kentucky Wildcats beat Notre Dame 68-66 to reach the Final Four, the men's national basketball championship tournament, as Kentucky tries to become college basketball's first undefeated champion in 39 years. They have to get past Wisconsin first in the semifinals. That's sports.
This is Science World Express. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Artificial illumination that lights up our nights can also be virtual magnets that attract a variety of disease-carrying insects into our homes. But a team of researchers led by Professor Travis Longcor from the University of Southern California found that LED light bulbs can be customized to provide illumination without attracting potentially dangerous insects. He tells us about his team's research and how a customized light bulb can save lives.
For outdoor lighting, know already that some types of lamps represent areas of the visual spectrum, the colors of the light, that do attract more insects. So, for example, light that is blue or violet or ultraviolet that we can't even see as humans is very attractive to moths. That's the reason that you can get bug lights from the hardware store that are yellow, and it has very yellow lights have very little blue in them. There are wide differences and are based on things that we do know already about the behavior of insects.
Speaking of insects, we're talking about insects that carry vector-borne diseases. What are we talking about? What kind of insects are we talking about, and what kind of diseases do they carry?
We'd be talking about things like mosquitoes that carry malaria, kissing bugs, sand flies, all of which carry diseases like Chagas disease and Leishmaniasis. And so these are all tropical, endemic tropical diseases that have insects that are the vectors that get the disease to people. The research on the connection between lighting and outbreaks of these insects is relatively new but solid. It's strongest for Chagas and Leishmaniasis, and the evidence is also there that mosquitoes are attracted to lights too, and so it stands to reason that that is part of the role that light lighting would play a role in exposure to mosquitoes as well.
Does the brightness of the light matter in attracting or distracting these insects?
Yeah, brightness does matter. So we're comparing lights that are relatively close in brightness. But one thing to remember is that there's a huge range of brightness that goes on between the middle of the day and what we have maybe for a light at night. So even something that might be quote-unquote twice as bright, the spectrum is actually more important than the brightness for that. But if we were talking about orders of magnitude brighter, then that brightness is going to be more important than the spectrum. And that was an interesting result that came out of our research, is that the brightness wasn't, and even though we had some variation in the brightness of the lamps that we used in the experiment, that brightness wasn't as important as the spectrum, the makeup of the light itself.
It was also suggested that you could go about perhaps fine-tuning these light bulbs so that they won't attract disease-carrying insects or affect humans in such a disrupting way. How would you go about doing that?
What we did is basically a proof of concept that you can use tunable LED bulbs, so light-emitting diodes, LEDs, which are very energy efficient, to create the appearance of, say, an incandescent bulb, 2700 Kelvin color temperature, with a combination of wavelengths that reduces the attractiveness to insects but still gives us what we need from the human eye to perceive it as being white light and usable for indoor use. The way in which LEDs here differ from other lamp types is that we can do this fine-tuning of the spectrum. You can't do that with a compact fluorescent bulb. The sort of spectral output is pretty much fixed, and the only way you can adjust it is through putting filters on it. Here we're not using filters. We're using different colored LEDs, different diode colors, red, blue, green, and white, to mix together to create something that looks white that would be very suitable in terms of color rendering and vision for indoor use, and yet has less output in the areas of the spectrum that insects are going to respond to. And we calculated that by taking the two insect response curves, which are published already for moths and for honeybees, and calculated how much the output of the different configurations that we had available from our collaborator Philips research. They produce these customizable LEDs to be able to pick the configurations that had the color temperature we wanted, the visual look that we wanted, but minimize the outputs in the areas of the spectrum that were most sensitive to insects. And then we compared those to an off-the-shelf LED and off-the-shelf compact fluorescent bulbs.
That was Professor Travis Longcore at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. Please visit us on the internet at voanews.com/science.
Many people around the world will be celebrating Easter next week. Here in the United States, kids grow up expecting a delivery of eggs and candy from the Easter Bunny every year. It may seem an odd tradition to an outsider, but while it's the norm in America, other countries have their own unique Easter celebrations. Like, don't forget a fork if you're in the southern French town of Hauts, France on Easter Monday. Each year, a giant omelet is served up in the town's main square, and I mean giant. The omelet uses more than 4,500 eggs. It feeds up to 1,000 people. As the story goes, when Napoleon and his army were traveling through the south of France, they stopped in a small town and ate omelets. Napoleon liked his so much that he ordered the townspeople to gather their eggs and make a giant omelet for his army the next day. And so the tradition goes. On the morning of Holy Saturday, the traditional pot throwing takes place on the Greek island of Corfu. People there throw pots and pans and other earthenware out of their windows, smashing them on the street. I guess it's a good day not to be walking on the street. Some say the custom derives from the Venetians, who on New Year's Day used to throw out all their old items, and others believe that the throwing of the pots welcomes spring and symbolizes new crops that will be gathered in the new pots, presumably because they no longer have the old pots because they smashed them. Interesting traditions coming up that you can look forward to on Easter. We have a tradition of leaving at this time every day. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer is Kelvin Fowler and Zainab Abdel-Rahman, and our managing editor is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We'll gather here again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.